It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll take a look at sleep deprivation and the adverse effects it can have on the body and the mind.
First, we take a look at a proposed change to Medicare that would beef up oversight for prescription drugs. Program officials are seeking new powers to better control and potentially bar doctors engaged in fraudulent or harmful prescribing.
And our next guest says it's a dramatic departure for the agency, which historically has been given much higher priority to making medications easily accessible to seniors and the disabled than to weeding out dangerous providers of health care. Joining us now is Charles Ornstein, senior healthcare reporter at ProPublica. Charlie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be back.
Well, I'm wondering, why is this happening now? Was there a perceived problem that they're trying to fix?
Well, we've been reporting at ProPublica about serious problems in Medicare's oversight of its prescription drug program, which is known as Part D, for many months. We found doctors who prescribed large quantities of risky and inappropriate medications to patients. We found doctors who were prescribing with an extensive dedication to brand name drugs when generics were widely available. And we found doctors whose prescribing patterns suggested that fraud was taking place with their provider IDs, either with their knowledge or without their knowledge. And I think that what we showed was that Medicare has the ability to track a whole lot. They fill one out of every four prescriptions in the country. They cover those, but they weren't doing much to track these sort of issues. So by bringing these issues to light, I think that they now realize they need to do more in this regard.
And with this fraudulent prescribing, is this in some cases doctors making money on the deal, or you mentioned without their knowledge, fraudsters using a doctor's identity to make money by getting these prescriptions?
Well, we've seen examples of both. We've talked to doctors who literally overnight went from having $200,000 in prescriptions attributed to them one year to having $4 million attributed to them the next, who said that they didn't know anything about this, and nobody from Medicare called to ask questions, that their provider identification numbers must have been stolen by somebody and used for drugs which they don't routinely prescribe to their patients. We talked to doctors who saw their prescriptions increase from $2 million a year to $8 million a year. And again, Medicare didn't ask questions. At the same time, we saw examples of physicians and podiatrists that were actively taking kickbacks from pharmacy chains and were convicted or pleaded guilty to charges of accepting kickbacks in exchange for writing prescriptions that were never dispensed but were charged to the Medicare Part D program.
So to enforce this now, what is new that we're hearing from Medicare this week?
Well, there's a couple major new developments. The first is that Medicare is planning to require that any physician who writes a prescription to a patient who's in Medicare Part D, so there's 36 million people, seniors and the disabled, who are in Medicare Part D, they would actually have to be enrolled in the Medicare program. Until now, any licensed provider could write a prescription to a patient in Medicare, and Medicare would fill that, but would have no way of even knowing who they were or if they had action taken against their licenses, that sort of thing. So going forward, Medicare intends to require that physicians who prescribe drugs to patients in the program actually have to be Medicare providers. The second thing is that they are giving themselves additional authority to kick doctors out of the Medicare program if their prescribing patterns appear dangerous or harmful or fraudulent. And so this could mean that they've had action taken against their medical license, a suspension or revocation in any state, if they're licensed in more than one state, for example, or they've had action taken against them by the DEA, or just if Medicare examines their prescribing patterns and trends and finds that they're aberrant or very, very different from their peers. We're not talking about people who are slightly different or who are, you know, just a little bit off. I mean, these are people who are dramatically off, who are prescribing reams of medications that may be inappropriate or harmful or fraudulent to patients.
We're talking orders of magnitude more, it sounds like, not just
Absolutely. A
little bit more here and there.
For sure.
Is there a concern that these enforcement measures might make it more difficult for some people who need medications to get them from the doctors they go to if they get caught up in this umbrella of enforcement?
So the Medicare has issued this as what's called a proposed rule. So that's their standard way of making big changes to the program. So people have an opportunity to comment on it before it goes into effect. But to your question, undoubtedly there will be changes because beginning in January of 2015, assuming this goes into effect as proposed, people who see doctors that are not Medicare providers will either have to have their doctors enroll in Medicare or seek an exception, or they'll have to find a new doctor. But at the same time, you have to think about this from the perspective of patient protection. So just allowing patients to get whatever drugs they want when they want them from any doctor willing to prescribe them may not be in their best interest. And it, in fact, may be in their interest to ensure that there is a consistent level of quality, or at least a minimum standard of quality for those prescribers.
Do we have a sense of how much this has been costing Medicare, and I guess by extension, us?
Right. So the Medicare Part D program costs taxpayers in excess of $60 billion a year. And particularly in cases in which doctors are heavy brand name prescribers, an individual doctor alone can account for as much as $10 million in prescribing in the program. So just making small differences and weeding out prescribers who are vastly different from their peers or who are prescribing in harmful or fraudulent ways can both save the program money but also protect beneficiaries who, you know, may be getting medications that addict them, may be getting medications that endanger their lives, or may just be getting medications that sedate them and put them in chemical comas when those medications may not be appropriate.
So not just costly here, but potentially dangerous for some people.
Unquestionably.
You also, I think, talked to some experts who suggested changes that weren't brought out this week by Medicare. What are some of the other ideas out there when it comes to fighting fraud in Medicare prescriptions?
Well, I think that one of the suggestions that we heard was that doctors should be required to write the diagnosis that they give to a patient on a prescription to ensure that as a pharmacy fills it and as insurance companies pay for it, that there's legitimate reasons that patients are getting prescriptions. And while doctors are certainly entitled to write prescriptions for indications that are not approved by the FDA, and this is a pretty common practice, in fact, there are some things like prescribing Alzheimer's medications to people who have autism, which don't have published research that supports their use, but yet we found an example of a physician who regularly does that. So by being able to understand what doctors are prescribing drugs for, you may be able to have conversations with those physicians or otherwise intervene if there's appears to be an indication of an inappropriate usage. Another one is to match the information that Medicare has in terms of which doctors patients see to information on prescriptions. So if a patient is getting prescriptions from a doctor who is not billing for treating them or in a different city, it may be an indication that Medicare should be asking questions, either because there could be evidence of fraud or that, you know, there may just be inappropriate prescribing or pill mills that are going on that Medicare may be interested in looking at.
So what you've talked about so far that Medicare actually is doing is requiring doctors to be registered with Medicare for Medicare to cover their prescriptions and having the ability to bump doctors out of Medicare for a variety of reasons, fraud, dangerous prescribing. Anything else in the new regulations that is noteworthy?
Yes. I mean, they also plan to change the list of drugs that have requirement that insurers have to cover all the drugs in the class. So these are what are called protected drug classes, and they're intended for drugs that are extremely important for patients and that restrictions that are imposed by insurance companies could harm their ability to access life-saving and very needed medications. But as Medicare has reevaluated this list, they've determined that not all the medications that are currently on the list, for example, antidepressants, need to be on the list. So according to their plan, some of those may be coming off in 2015. That's one thing to look out for.
That would not be all antidepressants. That would be some antidepressants.
It would basically give insurance companies the ability to set their own formularies from insurance company to insurance company and also to impose some restrictions. So for example, on newer antidepressants that would require that are very expensive, that it would permit insurance companies to make their patients perhaps try a generic first or obtain prior approval before they're able to get that medication. So it wouldn't take these medications away from patients. It wouldn't prevent patients from getting them. And in fact, some insurers may decide that they don't want to impose restrictions, but it would give insurance companies more ability to set requirements for coverage in these classes as they would, say, for a cholesterol drug.
So Medicare has floated these changes now. If all holds as it is, when would they go into effect?
So right now they're seeking comments from individuals about the changes, and they would go into effect beginning on January 1st of 2015.
Charles, thanks for joining us again today.
Thanks for having me back.
That's Charles Ornstein. He's senior healthcare reporter for ProPublica.
let's be honest here. How do you feel after a night of little or no sleep? Probably not very good. But what if you tried to go days without sleep?
As a teenager, our next guest tried doing just that, and he recently wrote about his experience. And in addition to the adverse health effects of sleeplessness, he says sleep deprivation is like torture. In some cases, sleep deprivation has actually been used as a form of torture.
Joining us now is Seth Maxon. He's a journalist, and his recent piece, How Sleep Deprivation Decays the Mind and Body, appeared in The Atlantic. We've got a link to it on the Central Time Facebook page. Seth, welcome to the show.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks.
So after all this time, we still don't fully understand why people need to sleep, and it seems like sleep deprivation is just about as misunderstood as sleep itself. Why is that?
Well, I can't really say why exactly, but it's hard to say. Things like eating and breathing, it's a lot easier to tell exactly what function those processes serve. We can see food providing our blood nutrients. We can see that our lungs need air to breathe. But with sleep, it's harder to tell exactly what's going on in the body and why exactly we need to do it.
Now, you had a personal experience with this. You were in high school, and you tried to go for days without sleep. Can you talk about why you did that and what happened?
Sure. So while I was a teenager, I started thinking for the first time about how, you know, life is short, and it's a pretty precious thing. And I got to thinking that, sleeping one third of each day, that just didn't seem like a very efficient use of a short period of time. And that bothered me. And I kind of thought, one day I'm going to see how long I can go without sleeping and see what I can accomplish in that time. So one day while I was actually on a school trip, in Europe, and I just decided to go for it. And, I had pretty terrible consequences. I kind of lost it a little, started behaving very bizarrely. And I had, adverse physical consequences as well. And I wound up in a hospital.
And it wasn't an easy ride even from then. You couldn't convince them, I guess, at the time that, okay, just need a little bit of shut-eye and then I'll be okay. I mean, we're talking about 4 months of medications to get you on your feet again.
That's right. And, I think that kind of speaks to how serious, sleep deprivation can be. I was having hallucinations. I was, behaving really bizarrely, and the doctors in the hospital at the time thought I had taken a lot of drugs, which I had not. It took a long time to wean off all the medication that I was given as soon as I arrived at the hospital.
Do you remember specifically what it felt like inside your head going that long without sleep?
It was, just physically, it was definitely kind of painful. I had, kind of a just persistent ache in my head. In terms of emotionally, it was very strange. It wasn't just about, being exhausted and having difficulty concentrating, although I certainly did have those feelings. I was making strange connections. I was coming up with theories left and right. I was hallucinating voices a little bit, and it was, in retrospect, it was very scary.
So is it possible when we are sleep deprived chronically or like you were for a period of days, I guess, what do we know about the damage we're doing to ourselves?
Well, there are several studies have come out to show all sorts of damage that can be done. The experts that I spoke with and the studies I looked at said that sleep deprivation and chronic sleep loss, that's sleep loss on a regular basis, can lead to heart problems, hypertension. It can, affect your immune system. It can lead to weight gain. Depression, it's been linked to. There's even one study that has shown chronic loss of sleep being linked to higher rates of mortality. So the consequences, though not universally agreed upon, are, when you start to read about them and talk to experts about them, reveal themselves to be quite severe.
Is it possible for sleep deprivation to actually kill us?
Yes, actually. You know, sleep deprivation, it can cause hypothermia, it can cause severe brain damage, and, you know, there have been some studies that have, well, first of all, there have been some people in the real world who have died of sleep deprivation. During the Euro Cup in 2012, there was a Chinese soccer fan who tried to stay up all night every night so he wouldn't miss a minute of the Euro Cup, and he wound up dying after staying awake for 11 days. Just this past summer, a young intern at Bank of America stayed up for 3 straight days and died after only three days of sleep deprivation.
Okay, so you got to ask, what is going on in our bodies? I mean, you've talked about some of the things that can happen that will tip us off balance, some high blood pressure and depression-like symptoms, heart symptoms. But, you know, when an autopsy is done, do we know? Can we finger the culprit?
You know, I can't say for sure, but I'm not an expert. But, you know, what effects of sleep deprivation ultimately can kill somebody are disputed. There's a study on rats that was done where, all of these things, such as hypothermia or severe brain damage, were discussed. And, you know, experts dispute what ultimately kills a person.
Now, there was an intriguing aspect in your article. Apparently, there's something in the blood called the S substance. I guess we don't know quite what it is, but when we sleep, we get rid of it. What is the S substance as we know about it?
Right. So what sleep experts have seen is that the longer and longer a person stays awake, the blood gets clogged with this substance that they refer to as substance S. And there are a lot of people who believe it to be adenosine, which is a byproduct of energy production. And, you know, the only way to clear the blood of this substance that clogs it up is to sleep. So, you know, that's very interesting to a lot of researchers, and they think finding out exactly what it is might be the key to understanding why people need to sleep.
Now, sleep deprivation has also been used, and we can start to see why as we talk here. It's been used as a form of torture, both in the Soviet Gulag and closer to home, I guess. We've been using it sometimes in Guantanamo. Why is sleep deprivation such effective torture?
Well, sleep deprivation is seen as a useful form of torture because interrogators see it as a way to break a prisoner's will to defy them. They see it as a useful way to break a prisoner's will to resist coercion as well. So they think it makes them more susceptible to coercion and more likely to, to confess or speak up or implicate others.
So for those of us who are listening to this and feeling alarmed about how much sleep we actually need, how much sleep do we need to be at our best and to kind of keep at bay some of the repercussions that can come up in terms of our health?
Well, the studies that I looked at and the experts I spoke to said that on average, most people need about 7 1/4 hours of sleep a night. The studies have shown that, you know, the people that get 7 1/4 hours of sleep are healthier and sometimes even live longer than those who get less or more.
And can we make it up when we've had a bad couple of nights?
You know, that's a little bit of a misconception, is catching up on sleep. I've done it. I'm sure a lot of people have done it where, you know, you get 4 or 5 hours of sleep and then you say, I'll make up for it on the weekend. But, you know, you can't really do that if you do it on a very regular basis. For instance, if you have a work schedule or any kind of schedule that has you sleeping about 5 or 6 hours of sleep a night during the week, and then you want to make up for that during the weekend. You know, if you do the math, it doesn't quite work out, because you're talking about needing to get 7 hours of sleep, just as a baseline of what you need, and then an additional, 10 or 12 extra hours of sleep. And frankly, that's just not going to happen.
All right. So we have to guard this carefully, guard our sleep. Seth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Veronica.
We've been talking to Seth Maxon, a journalist based in New York City. His piece on sleep deprivation recently appeared in The Atlantic.
There's been a long-term shift from manufacturing jobs to service work, and our next guest is tracking what that means for workers and for the economy. In new research, he says there's an increasing polarization in our workforce between a small number of higher-skilled workers and a growing number of lower-paid service workers with little hope of boosting their income. David Otter joins us now. He's a professor of economics at MIT. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, first, how big a shift has there been from manufacturing to service employment in the United States?
Well, that shift from manufacturing to service employment has been going on for a very long time. In fact, the sort of high point of U.S. manufacturing was, you know, shortly after the end of the Second World War, when something like 40% of U.S. workers were in manufacturing. So we've been moving into the service economy for decades. What's more recent is the movement into so-called service occupations. Let me be clear what I mean by that. So the service sector, not manufacturing, is kind of everything from software to hospitals. It's just, you know, stuff that isn't making goods. Service occupations are occupations that involve helping, assisting, or caring for other people. They might include, you know, food service, security, home health aides, cleaning, landscaping, things like that. These are jobs that require kind of dexterity, flexibility, typically spoken language, but not a lot of formal training or education beyond kind of basic literacy and sometimes basic numeracy. And so they're jobs that can be done by a lot of people. So on the one hand, that's good. It means that they're open, they're accessible. On the other hand, that's not good, but because it means the skills to do them are not scarce, and so they tend not to be highly paid.
So if people are relying on a job like this for their career, as opposed to a manufacturing job or a high-skill, high-paid job, what are their income prospects through life?
In general, they're quite modest. Jobs of the type I'm describing typically have relatively low pay. They comprise a disproportionate share of minimum wage jobs, and also very limited security because, as said, the skills are broadly available, meaning that people are relatively interchangeable. So, you know, it's not that hard to replace a food service worker or a cleaning worker relative to someone who has specialized knowledge in manufacturing technology or in you know, the way your particular office or business works. And so I think the combination of relatively modest income potential and not a lot of job security, it makes those jobs difficult for a primary earner.
And if I'm looking at your research right, for the most part, once somebody enters into this career path, there's a good chance they're going to be there to stay.
Well, you know, it depends. I mean, many people do that type of work as a youngster. You know, I worked in food service when I was a kid, when I was a teenager and young adult. It's a question, I think it's more likely if you don't have more formal training or skills, it's harder to – there's not so much a career ladder in that type of work, right? So, being a waitress or security guard a janitor, you're usually limited upward mobility options in that type of work. You won't go typically from doing that job to running the company.
How has pay progressed over the years for these service occupations?
Well, so looking, you know, in general, looking across advanced economies, wages and service occupations tend to be at the bottom of the distribution. In the U.S., we've had very slow growth in lower-paying jobs for a very long time. Really, since in general, wage growth in the U.S. has been slow since the early 1980s, but it's been much slower at the bottom than at the top. In fact, at the top, it's been quite rapid. And so pay has not advanced rapidly. There was a period in the 1990s when, you know, associated with this sort of the dot-com bubble, when everyone's earnings were growing and wages in service occupations actually grew a little bit faster in percentage terms than the average, but still from a very low base. But the 2000s have not been particularly kind for relatively lower paid workers, and so wage growth again has been modest in those occupations or even non-existent. Ironically, the fastest job growth during the 2000s has occurred in relatively low-paying in-person service jobs. Maybe I should say a few words about where that type of employment growth is coming from. So we talked about initially the movement from manufacturing into services, and why are people moving into these service occupations? One of the most important reasons, arguably, is the nature of technological change, which mm-hmm. has made it increasingly easy to substitute machinery, computer-driven machinery, for people doing formerly skilled but relatively rules-based tasks. So if you think about a lot of production line work or even office clerical work, that's work that often follows sort of well-scripted procedures that required, you know, educated people to follow those procedures carefully, but increasingly we've gotten good at getting computers to follow procedures carefully. So, you know, whether it's storing, filing, and retrieving information, or whether it's, you know, moving parts around dexterously on an assembly line, increasingly we have machines that can do those types of tasks. What we don't have machines that are good at are, on the one hand, a lot of very highly skilled work like that's associated with medicine and science and engineering, where you're developing hypotheses, solving new problems, creating products. Some of those things can be automated, but many of those things require kind of creativity and intuition that we don't really know how to automate yet. We may someday, but arguably those jobs are complemented. On the other hand, another set of jobs that we're also not good at automating are things that require people to be very flexible, to work in an uncertain environment. So, for example, you know, it's easy at this point, comparatively easy to make a robot that can install a windshield on a car on an assembly line, because that's a very well-controlled environment with very little variation. However, you would not have a robot coming out to your house to replace the windshield that broke on your car, because that requires a person who can work in an unfamiliar situation where, you know, each car would be different, each setting is different. And so jobs that require people to be physically adaptive, to visually recognize things, to navigate in a kind of uncertain terrain, those things still very much require human skills. So that describes, waiting tables, that describes working on a construction site, that describes, even cleaning a house. You know, your vacuum cleaner can't walk upstairs and clean the upstairs for you, even though you'd like it to. And so that means that there's lots of work for people to do that won't be automated. But unfortunately, those skills, although they're very difficult to automate, they're very relatively easy for humans, which makes them abundant. I should also say, by the way, a second factor that makes these jobs particularly durable in terms of not being subject to other forces that tend to push against them is that they also mostly need to be done in person. In other words, if you're going to get a haircut or go for a meal or have
your house cleaned, you can't get an e-haircut.
Yeah, that doesn't have to. You can't get that done overseas. It can't be traded, and so that means again, you know, if they're not subject to this sort of technological replacement at the moment, and they're not subject to trade, that means they will be done by workers. So it means they're relatively abundant, but again, not relatively high paying.
So if you've got this polarization, the higher skilled, less replaceable jobs at the top, and then the jobs we're mostly talking about here, where a lot of people can potentially do them, this polarization of what people are getting paid, what has you most worried about that? We hear a lot about income inequality. Is that a problem societally as well as for the people who aren't getting paid much money?
Yes. I would say there are several problems. So in general, it certainly contributes to inequality of income when you have a lot of, a fair amount of very relatively low paid employment and then a stratum of very high paid at the top. That's one issue. But in terms of what I worry about even more directly is sort of the quality of opportunity for individuals in those positions. So if you don't have the good fortune to, go to college and get a highly skilled job, if you just have a high school education or maybe some college and you don't find your way into something that has like a medical paraprofession or manufacturing or an office job that has some durability, then these positions are not going to offer the kind of wage growth over a lifetime or employment security that people that's so desirable, especially if you're responsible for a family. So I think on the one hand, the pay is low. It's also, if you jobs don't offer opportunity, that's also typically discouraging. So I think it detracts from the enjoyment of work, and people want to and need to enjoy their work, or hopefully at least that we want them to, and I'm sure they want to. I equally well worry that affects the kind of quality of opportunity they can offer to their own children, because if you have limited resources, it's harder to send your kids to good schools, to make the kind of investments of time and resources in providing opportunity for them. So I worry that it ultimately not only reduces opportunities for workers in these positions, but reduces, can potentially reduce mobility in our society, the chance that their kids have better opportunities.
MIT economist David Autor is with us talking about a growing divide in the workforce, with more and more people in service jobs with little prospect for better paying work. And you can join in. Are we talking about you? Do you work in one of these service occupations we've been talking about? Do you see a chance for better pay in your future, either with the job you're in or by making some kind of change? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. We pick up our conversation now with David Autor, professor of economics at MIT. His latest research looks at the growing number of people doing lower-paying work in service occupations, everything from food service, home health care, a lot of other things like that, and seeing little hope for increased pay over their careers. You can join in. Are you doing this kind of work now? Are you worried about the impact of people making more money at higher skilled professions and a lot of people not having the prospects to do that at the lower end? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org. Get your calls in just a few moments. But David, are there policy changes that you think your research might point to? Are there things that aren't, that the government isn't doing that maybe they ought to be?
Well, a controversial but well liked by the populace and increasingly accepted policy by economists is the minimum wage. For non-traded activities like many of these service occupations, there's headroom where one could raise earnings without seeing the jobs go overseas. And although, canonical economic theory says if you make something more expensive, you get less of it. So, there's always a danger of raising wages too high such that they lower employment. The evidence that we've seen over the last 20 years suggests that U.S. minimum wages are just not high enough to really have a big adverse effect on employment. So in general, raising the minimum wage is one way to increase the real earnings of workers without having, as far as we can tell, substantial consequences, adverse consequences on employment. So there's room to do that. In addition, I actually think the new healthcare law should actually improve the quality of life for many individuals who would be doing relatively low-paid work, because traditionally those people have earned enough that they haven't qualified for Medicaid, but not enough that employers are going to be providing health care for them. So I actually think that's a big policy step in the right direction. The Earned Income Tax Credit is another policy we've had that's been very successful at making work pay for people who don't have great labor market options. And I would actually like to see that expanded. In particular, the Earned Income Tax Credit is targeted at families with dependent children, but people doing service occupations could be older individuals or middle-aged individuals without children, could be unmarried men, et cetera. And I don't see any reason why we wouldn't also want to help make work pay better for them.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Joe on the line in Prairie du Chien. Joe, hi.
Hi. I'm curious to guest thoughts. Are we in a position where we are going into the spiral of servicing ourselves in our economy and not addressing the world market? Are we going down a slippery slope where we will not be competitive as the future unfolds?
That's an interesting question. I think that yes, the U.S. has certainly lost its some competitive ground in producing manufactured goods. U.S. manufacturing employment has fallen very substantially, actually, over the last decade. The U.S. continues to be a producer of high value-added goods, but in terms of employment much, much less so. Increasingly, we do export services like banking services and business services. I do think, yes, there is a concern that that many of these positions have, the issue, a long-standing problem with service-type positions is they have relatively low productivity growth over time. We just don't get better at them much faster, and so that means it's harder for real living standards to rise much faster. So if you think about what a barber does or a concert musician does or even what a teacher does, those are all important jobs, but they, the rate of progress in getting, better at haircutting or making concert music or teaching is really quite slow over the course of decades, and so I do think that is it does kind of create a long term drag on productivity.
Thanks for the question, Joe. We'll go to Jocelyn in Sheboygan now. Jocelyn, hi.
Hi. I call this economic slavery. And also the exploitation of people, especially now when there are no jobs or very few. They were saying it's three people to one job, and probably it's even more than that. But also when NAFTA was signed, I think that was a death knell for this country. And also I heard or read somewhere that also it affected Mexico in an adverse way.
All right, I want to jump in, Jocelyn, and get a guest response. First, on NAFTA, how much is, you touched on it briefly, I think, earlier, but how much is globalization a factor in the decline of the higher-paying jobs that these service jobs are replacing?
Well, globalization, actually much more competition from China than Mexico, has been an important factor in the decline of U.S. manufacturing employment over the last 20 years, and especially in the last 10. I actually think the importance of NAFTA per se was probably oversold by both critics and advocates 20 years ago. However, the rise of and probably had more consequences in Mexico, not all of them positive, not all of them negative. China's rise as a very low-cost, high-quality, productive country that's also very large over the last 20 years has certainly displaced a lot of labor-intensive U.S. manufacturing in textiles and footwear and rubber products. And so that has reduced U.S. manufacturing employment substantially.
But on the other hand, how much is the, and again, you touched on this briefly earlier, is increasing use of technology taking away the jobs? Because one worker now does the job with the robots helping him or her of many workers in the past.
I think technology is the larger factor. I think most economists would agree with that. And even many of these labor-intensive positions, if they were not traded, would in fact see declining employment over time. Now, there's a plus side to these things as well. Technological change makes us more productive. It contributes to national wealth. Trade also allows us to perform things in which we have comparative advantage, also contributes to national wealth. However, those gains are not generally broadly shared or not necessarily broadly shared. National wealth can be growing while some people are getting very rich and others are getting pretty poor. So I think the difficulty with both the technological change and these trade forces is they kind of both contributed to eroding opportunities in the middle, boosting opportunities at the top and not doing much for people who don't have high levels of education. And so the prosperity has not been broadly shared.
We had economist Tyler Cowen on the show, and he was making kind of similar a case for the future of this polarized economy. And to sum it up in a nutshell, his argument was, it's going to happen. Adjust your expectations if you're in this lower half. Enjoy the fact that we have fairly cheap stuff to buy with your limited income. Is that it? Is that the best hope for people in these service occupations?
No, I'm familiar with Tyler's work, and I think he's a very interesting, provocative thinker. But I think that that's extrapolating a little bit too far from what we actually know. One of my mentors often says, look, I enjoy science fiction and I enjoy history, but I believe in more in history than I do in science fiction. and that's a pretty extreme view. I think there's we've gone, for example, if we were having this conversation that we're 1999, we'd just be talking about the wonderful decade we had of technological change with rising incomes and all kinds of new opportunities. And so I think that, you know, economic growth will return. I think there will be opportunity, but it's crucial to craft policy to help us take advantage of it. Over the long term, the policies that are most effective are investing in the skills of our workforce and investing in the education of younger people.
But I always wonder when people say that, if the jobs out there don't require this high-skilled training, how much help is skills training going to be?
Well, so there are many high-skilled jobs. In fact, the wages of college graduates and people with post-college education have risen substantially over the last three decades. And if we'd had more college graduates and fewer non-college, there would have been more shared prosperity. So on the one hand, I think that's important. Also, the point I made earlier, the wages of these jobs are determined by the supply of people available to do them. So if there are relatively few people who can do them or who want to do them because they have better opportunities, those jobs will have to pay higher wages.
Are you an optimist looking ahead, especially with the generational issue you mentioned earlier? The expectation was always that our kids would be a little better off than us. A lot of people are thinking that's not the case anymore. Is it going to be again?
I think it will be. I just don't think we're not. I don't think the U.S. is going to have the type of extraordinary year over year, decade over decade growth rates that we saw after the end of the Second World War up through the mid 1970s. That three decade period, which everyone sort of views as the U.S. normal, is an extremely exceptional period for any period of U.S. history, any period of world history. However, I don't think we're on a downward slide where living standards will be falling and there will be no employment, and sort of we'll have a mass disruption of the type of economic system that we have enjoyed. I think there are challenges. I think that we will not have, incredibly rapid growth across the board, but I'm not as pessimistic as many.
David, thanks a lot for joining us and spending time with us today.
Okay, pleasure talking with you. Thanks for the great questions. Thanks to your callers as well.
That was David Otter, professor of economics at MIT.